When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain. We will do, of course, some theater down the line, but I want to open up with an important new book on a fascinating topic, one that, depending on, you know, your background or where you grew up, is a topic that there's always more to read, and it's always a fascinating read. The book is called The Art of Inventing Hope, Intimate Conversations with Elie Wiesel, and it's written by Howard Reich, who you very well likely know from his work in the music world, along with other books and other things that he's written, certainly, and films that he's done. But over at this Tribune, he's been the writer about jazz and blues and gospel and classical music, and we have some mutual friends. And Howard, it's just so great to talk to you. Welcome.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks a million.
Absolutely. So, this book, at first when I was reading with the, you know, different books you've written in your past, I thought, okay, where's this one coming from? And then, of course, it became very clear very quickly from page one. And that's because this is a very personal story. So tell the listeners exactly your tie to this event and maybe who Elie Wiesel was.
Well, so Elie Wiesel is famously a Holocaust survivor, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and in much of his life, he became the voice of Holocaust survivors. Not by his choice, the world kind of accorded him this stature. Everyone turned to him for explanation and understanding. He wrote over 60 books, and he changed the way the world thinks about Holocaust survivors, because after the Holocaust, there was some measure of shame among survivors. They were rendered pariahs. They were marginalized. People did not want to hear their story. And thanks to Elie Wiesel's constantly speaking around the world, from Little Synagogue to the United Nations, thanks to all the books and articles that he wrote, he made the world realize that these survivors actually are heroic people. They survived the worst that the 20th century had to offer, and then they went on and they rebuilt, and they had families, children, grandchildren. They rebuilt despite what happened to them. And it so happens that I am the son of two survivors. But in my case, and in many, in fact, according to the literature, in most cases, most survivor parents did not tell their children about what happened to them. It's totally understandable. It's a story that's impossible to describe anyway, and the parents did not want to burden their children with these stories. And so I, too, grew up with this kind of blank. I did not know what happened, but because of something dramatic my mother did one night in 2001, I was forced to confront this past. And because of all my writings on this Holocaust and my parents ever since, the Tribune called me one day in 2012 to tell me that Elie Wiesel had been awarded the Tribune's Literary Prize, and would I be interested in interviewing him for an article in the Tribune, and then later on the stage of Orchestra Hall? And of course, my answer was yes, and thus began a very unexpected relationship and friendship with Elie Wiesel,
which you had for 4 years prior to his death, and many visits in New York and Florida as he went back and forth. One of the things you write, it's sort of interesting. I mean, I grew up in Skokie, as you did, and so we were surrounded by Holocaust survivors, all of my neighbors, everybody, though it wasn't part of my family's history. But one of the things you write is, if you're a child of a survivor, it stays always with you, whether you know it or not. So your parents, your mom, did not talk about this, and yet the story was yours as well. How is that?
Well, this was, I think, the 800-pound gorilla in our house, the subject that was not discussed, but that was always there. And as I alluded to briefly just a moment ago, on the night of February 15, 2001, my mother, who by then was a 69-year-old widow living in the Skokie house where I grew up, that night she ran out of her house with two bags passed, insisting someone was trying to kill her. Mm. She was picked up by the Skokie police. The next night she did it again, and it took us a long time to realize what she's really doing is reenacting her flight, her running for her life during 3 years during the Holocaust as a child. And so when I learned this story about my mother and made it a story in the Tribune, and then it became a book and a documentary film, when I did all this, I had to begin to go back and reevaluate what that childhood was like, what was really happening in our house, and reinterpret what those first 49 or so years of my life were. And I realized that the subject was there all the time, that my parents were both two very traumatized people. As I've told others, I have no image in my mind of my mother in bed. I can only see my mother at night in my mind's eye, sitting on the living room floor of our darkened house at night, peering out the window, keeping a kind of vigil. I imagine the kind of vigil she had to keep when she was running and hiding as a child. And so that is how I came to understand more of what happened, because of now finding out through work what my mother's story was and what my father's story was. And I wasn't aware of it growing up.
You know, as you talk, it reminded me, I have neighbors who had a note on their door. You had to ring the bell. You could not knock on their door. Now, this is decades mm-hmm. after the Holocaust, and yet they were survivors, yeah. child survivors. And that was because it's what the Nazis did. They knocked on your door and said, get on the truck. And to the day they died, you could not knock on their door without them just completely freaking out. You write that one of the reasons the survivors may not have talked, you just raised so many questions that were so critical, so I'm going to ask you them. You talk about the fact that it was their fear of your pain or judgment that could be rendered on them, and maybe from the child.
So I think there are many reasons they didn't speak. And I've learned this through interviewing many survivors and studying my parents' story. But one theme that survivors often say is, one quote they often say is, there are no words to describe what happened. They could not find words to put to these indescribable, incalculable kind of events that happened to them and their families. And I think, as I say, the world did not want to hear their story, and the world made clear to them that their story was not wanted. It was something the world could not bear to hear. So when did that change? I think it started to change, especially in the Chicago area, between 1976 and 1978. Mm. And that is when Frank Collin, a neo-Nazi, threatened to march on the streets of Skokie.
I remember that
and as
morning.
You say, yeah, and as you say, if knocking on a door re-traumatized someone who survived the Holocaust, imagine what seeing this man in a brown shirt, brown pants, boots, and a swastika would do to those people. It re-traumatized them. And they were determined not to let that happen. And this went on for almost 2 years until it was resolved. And so at that point, the survivors in Skokie began to come out. They outed themselves because they were going to stop Frank Collin. And then they built the museum in Skokie. At first, it was a Holocaust museum. First was a little storefront on Costner Avenue, about three blocks from my parents' house, and then it became the great brick structure that we know in elsewhere in Skokie. And in the United States also began to recognize this in 1978, when the TV series Holocaust was on TV. The subject finally was becoming part of the American discourse. And then in the 1990s, when the big Holocaust Museum opened in Washington, D.C., so a subject that we talk about quite a bit now, everybody's aware of it, I think, or whether they accept it or not, it's a subject out there, was virtually not talked about as I was growing up. And that's a profound change and a positive one.
You mentioned the Supreme Court case. I remember that. I remember studying it in grad school at the time. And what people may not remember, when you said it kind of resolved itself, well, it's not because Jewish survivors won. In fact, the Supreme Court said the Nazis had a right to march. Let's not get into that long conversation. But essentially, the court's position was, look, that's what freedom of speech is all about. Remember the famous line, pull your shades. And I can remember my neighbors, who were the most peaceful people in the world, who went to the JCC that morning, where so many survivors were meeting with clubs in their hands, with knives. There was going to be a bloodbath. And the reason it resolved was because Frank Collins, who I believe later on got picked up on pedophilia charges, no reason not to mention that. But at the same time, they were ready to, there would have been death and destruction, and the Nazis never showed.
That's true. So it was almost as if this Solomonic decision had happened. The Nazis and the ACLU, which represented them, won in the Supreme Court. They were given the right, they affirmed their right to march. And the survivors won on the streets in the Skokie, because Collin and his people, having fought this battle for two years, did not march in Skokie. And I agree with you. I think they were afraid to. They're afraid of what would happen. The survivors were armed. And I think Collin may have thought, the police just might have looked the other way. So this is how the decision was split. First Amendment is preserved. The march did not happen.
Yeah. By the way, very, very briefly, I did not know this, and tell me if I'm reading this correctly in the book, but you basically say Wiesel actually coined the term Holocaust in this context, right? I mean, to me, it's just always been known as the Holocaust, but he was instrumental in attaching that name to this event.
He was. Now, it's always difficult or risky to say anybody was the first, but he surely was among the very first to use this term. And he said because he felt that it came close to expressing what was happening. It meant to burn and with fire. And so he felt that was the right word. He came to, in a way, regret that because the term became so ubiquitous and is used so often that he said people were diluting or diminishing the meaning of the term. He said he would see on TV, they refer to a sports event where there's a wipeout, they call it a Holocaust. And he said some events are some words are copyrighted by events. And so he even didn't use that word much later on. He would simply refer to it as the event with a capital E, or he would say what we so inadequately call the Holocaust. But he grieved that the word had become used in such general terms and not for the exclusive events that he applied it to.
You know, as you say, we can never relate to what they went through. You write about survivor syndrome, the fact that your dad once said to you, I've lived 120 years, and only he mm-hmm. and people like him can understand what that meant. But I want to ask you the question that you titled Chapter 6 with. You ask the question, why do they hate us? And you address it in Chapter 6, but I'll let you address it here. Why are Jews always the subject of such persecution? Religious, social issues, you raise those.
Well, so I asked, of course, Professor Wiesel the same thing. And he responded by saying that he considers anti-Semitism the oldest hatred. That for as long as there was Jews, there was hatred of Jews. He said he could not understand why. Till the very end, I talked to him for those last 4 years of life, he was struggling with this. Why? What did Jews do? What did Jews do to earn or to deserve or to receive such hatred? He did not find an answer to that. What he did know is that it goes back to time immemorial, to biblical times, and that it has not diminished to today. I'm often asked, what would Professor Wiesel say about the anti-Semitic attacks that we see today in Europe and more recently, even in the United States, violent anti-Semitic attacks? And I always say, he would say to me what he said to me when I would ask him about this. He would say, I'm shocked, but not surprised. In other words, that this is happening is an offense to humanity and it is shocking. And yet it has never been different. It has always been thus. And that's why he said to me that regarding anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, that there always will be deniers. And he said, as time goes by, there will be no more deniers rather than fewer. And they say it couldn't have happened. It didn't happen. And he said, that's why we have to continue to write more and speak more and make sure that this is not forgotten and that this is not denied. That was his cause. He did not think he had succeeded. He did not think that he had changed the world in recognizing what had happened and what needs to be remembered. But he never stopped fighting for that battle.
When the Holocaust Museum and Educational Center opened in Skokie, I did a special on it called Site of Remembrance. And one of my interviews was Fritzi Fritschl, who I know you know, everybody does, sure. As a survivor. But one of the questions I asked her was, do you still believe in God? And her answer to me, which just still stirs me to this day, was, I believe if there's a God, he sat with his back to us on the fence at Auschwitz. You raised the question, how did Jews and other people, because it wasn't only Jewish people who were killed, of course, but how did they keep their faith?
Well, I did ask Professor Wiesel about this, and this is something that he struggles with, too. He said, if he simply stops believing, that's it, I'm finished, there's no God, there's no faith, that's fine, you're done. He said, it's easy. It's a very easy answer. And he said that's not of interest to him. He says he loves the complexities and the contradictions of Jewish life and Jewish studies and Jewish writings. That's what interests him. And he, too, said that he feels that Jews were abandoned by God during the Holocaust. But he says in spite of that, he refuses to give up his faith in spite of God. He'll believe in God in spite of God. He believed it was part of his tradition. He said his grandfather believed, his father believed. This is part of who he is. And he would rather try to deal with this, what happened within faith than outside of faith. He said he cannot think of Auschwitz, which he survived, either with God or without God. It's something separate. He said this is something that was created not by God, but by man. It didn't come down from heaven ready-made. It was created by God's children against other God's children. And he refused, like many survivors, to relinquish that faith, regardless and despite what happened.
You raise the question in the book as well, can we forgive? Can we ever forgive? But I'm not going to ask you that question. I mean, I'll include that. But not only can we forgive, I guess I want to add on to that, should we forgive?
Well, this is something Professor Wiesel and I talked about. I was pretty unyielding about this. I think some offenses cannot be forgiven. You know, turning right on red is one thing. Stepping on someone's toe is one thing. The mass genocide of more than 6 million people, to me, is something that cannot be forgiven. But if you ask Professor Wiesel that, he says, he would say, and he did say to me, I cannot forgive for the Jewish people who were killed. Only the dead can forgive. And I think that gives a sense of what he felt about this situation. It's beyond words, it's beyond language, and it's beyond forgiveness, in my opinion.
I'm sure you were very pleased. You write towards the end of the book, when you sent him this book, you expected him to rip it up and not rip it up, but I mean basically give you all sorts of criticism and say, hey, here's your problems, Howard. And you meet him in the lobby. He had no book in his hand. It surprised you, but that's because he felt pretty good about it.
Well, this was amazing. So I've been working this book almost 4 years, our interviews, transcribing, just working on it. And I had told him at the beginning of this process, no one will see this manuscript before you, not my agent, not any publisher, not my wife, no one. You will be the first. And I said that to him right at the beginning. And so the time came. I sent it to him in Florida. It was the winter when he was teaching in Florida. And he said, send it to me and then come to Florida. So I was very much looking forward. I was actually looking forward to the process of spending days ripping it apart and, as you say, moving this paragraph and taking that paragraph out and so forth. And we meet in the lobby of a hotel, and he is not holding the manuscript. And I thought, this is not the world's greatest sign. So then we sat down at the usual chairs, and we had our pleasantries back and forth. And then I finally said to him, so would you like to go over the book? He said, no. I said, well, really? I mean, perhaps would you like to go over the manuscript with me? He said, no, it's fine. Very good. Nothing to change. And that was it. That was the entire editing process. And I had reserved a week for this editing process. So we just spent the rest of the week talking, sitting around as we always had done, enjoying each other's company and me learning, you know, from the master. So that was a bittersweet moment in the sense that I was tremendously relieved that I had gotten it right and that I had understood what he was trying to say and that he ascribed to what I had written here. But I was looking forward to the process of working on it with this great master of writing, and that part didn't happen. And then, of course, I was as shocked or more as anyone in the world when in 2016 he died. That never entered in my mind, even though he was in his late 80s. I always assumed that our conversation would continue and continue. And when he died, I was shocked. I was shocked as everybody was, even though he was an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor. But at the same time, I felt so grateful that not long before he had read the manuscript. He had given me his stamp of approval, because if that had not happened, I would be left to this day wondering, did I get it or didn't I? And now at least I know that.
Truly, some might say that is beshert, or obviously meant to be.
And that's
probably true. I will say one of the, I have, you know, a signed book collection, and one of my prized possessions is a signed book by Wiesel of his book Night, which is probably the critical book that people want to read if you want to read about this era.
Yeah, it is. And it's his first book. And it's the only book he did not write in French. He wrote all the other books in French. They were translated. But this is his first book, and he wrote it in Yiddish. And I asked him, why did you write that book in Yiddish? He said, because Yiddish is my homeland.
It's beautiful. There's so much more to talk about, and people will get to interact with you and meet you and get the book and have you sign the book. You are going to sign the book, right?
Of course.
Okay. You'll have to sign mine, actually, now that I think about it. But anyway, Howard will be appearing at the Spertus Museum, Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership, this Sunday, December 15th at 2 p.m. It's not an expensive event. $18 just to show up there. $10 if you are a member of the museum. You can get tickets at spertus.edu. That's spertus.edu. And again, it is the event is this Sunday at 2 p.m. You're going to be interviewed by a woman we both know, Allison Pure Sloven. So let her know that I said hello. She is the Midwest director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And she's been on my Politics Tonight show to talk about the rise of anti-Semitism. In fact, it would be nice to have you join me and have that conversation soon. It's a dialogue that has to keep going on, right?
Anytime. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Congratulations on this, another book to add to the shelf. And again, on all that you do, always read your reviews and your comments in the Tribune on music. I have a few we should talk about that. We'll see if we agree or not. But anyway, it's always a pleasure to read that. Congratulations. The book is The Art of Inventing Hope. It is about intimate conversations he had with Elie Wiesel. And you can see him this Sunday, 2 p.m. at the Spertus Center at 610 South Michigan Avenue. Tickets at spertus.edu. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you, sir. It was a great talk. Thank you.
In all your fantasies, you always knew that man and mystery were both in you. And in this
You know that. I don't even have to tell you what show we're about to talk about, because that is Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera, one of the most classic musicals probably ever written. And returning to Chicago in the role of the Phantom is a man you may have also seen as Mufasa in the national tour of The Lion King. And, oh my goodness, he was in Carousel and on, Derek Davis, the Phantom, this time around, joins me, along with being a solo artist, by the way. Derek, welcome back to the podcast, because I think you and I talked the last time you were here.
Yes, we certainly did. Thank you for the welcome back. It's good to be back.
You got it. And Phantom of the Opera, which is currently playing at the Cadillac Palace Theater from December 18th to January 5th. What is it about this show? Because, you know, I saw Phantom in its first run on Broadway. It had to have been around 19, maybe 88, something like that. It really had relatively just opened, as I recall. What is it about this show that it just won't go away? And I mean that as a compliment, because people just love it.
Well, it's absolute genius, obviously.
Yeah, right?
It really is, I think, a number of different factors. The music, number one, obviously, is timeless, and people can latch on to the melodies and go home singing them and everything like that. The storyline is just so iconic. So many shows have tried to emulate the storyline of the love triangle and everything like that, and have unfortunately not been as successful as this show has been. But also, the characters at their core, each and every one of them, are so human. Even though the show presents them in a fantastic manner, their humanity is just so relatable on so many different levels.
So we're told this production is we're told it's a new production by Cameron McIntosh, of course, who has so many classic hits behind him. For folks like me who saw it back in the 80s and in the 90s, whatever, what is it we see that will strike as being different in this production?
Well, you know, it's been around for 30 plus years now, and so technology has made incredible strides in that amount of time. And so this show has a new and re-envisioned set design. It's a lot darker, a lot grittier, a lot more human. The inter-character relationships are a lot deeper and explored in a new and a fresh way. But also things like the sound system. We carry with us a surround sound system that is state-of-the-art. Our lighting system we carry with us as well. And then just the performers, acting in general, has found new heights and new levels and new depths as well. And so we bring that to the stage as well. But the costumes and the music and the storyline, all of that is completely intact and will bring back the nostalgia that everybody has for the show.
And if there's anybody who has never seen the show before, I'll carefully ask this question, which is, those of us who are hoping to see a chandelier, will we?
Oh, you will. And you will see it in high style. it's one of the most fantastic versions of the chandelier worldwide, so we're excited to have that there in Chicago.
And I know that anybody who hasn't seen the show says, what the heck are they talking about? Well, just go see the show and you'll know exactly what we're talking about.
And
the music. So again, the show's been around a long time, as you've said, and you've done so many other roles, Lion King, whatever, but does it ever get tiring? Do you get on stage 8 times a week and perform these numbers, and sometimes does it run through your head by going, oh my God, this has been singing this for 30 years? Or do you just love it because I love it every time I hear it. I've never gotten tired of it.
Yeah. You know, it's a strange phenomenon that I do get physically tired, but I don't get tired of the music and I don't get tired of the story. You have to remember that every time the performers get on the stage and the audience fills the house, it's a completely different chemistry that occurs. You know, that's why live theater is so phenomenal, because it's literally, even though it's the same show every night, it's a completely different show every night, because everybody brings to the table something a little bit different, something a little bit fresh. So it keeps it, you know, exciting for all of us.
Do you find when people, you know, wait at the stage door and want to say hi to you, do you find that you're getting a lot of young people who just love the theater and this is a first experience? Or do you find folks maybe who are a little more seasoned who just say, oh, man, I saw it like I did to you. You know, I saw this years ago, but I still love it. What experience do you have with audience members who get to interact with you when they see you?
That's exactly what it is, to be quite honest. You get both sides of the spectrum, which makes me so happy, because you have the people who have been like immersed in art their entire life, and they come and they show their gratitude, and they have stories to tell and stories to share, where they were engaged or it was an anniversary, or they went with their parents and their parents no longer live. But you also have the next generation that's just as, if not more, excited about musical theater, and they're coming and they're bringing fresh, you know, excitement to the stage and to the house and everything. And so it's just such a beautiful, beautiful thing that art is, specifically musical theater art.
You know, I don't know did you happen to see the touring company of Love Never Dies, which is really the quote-unquote sequel to Phantom of the Opera?
Yeah, I did not see it, unfortunately. I'm so disappointed that I didn't get a chance to.
Well, I'll give you the WGN tie, because the son of our news director, the son of our big boss, his name is Casey Lyons, and he played Gustav in that show on the national tour. And
did he really?
So, yeah, and in fact, I had Karen Mason on a couple of weeks ago for a concert she was doing. So it's just kind of that whole Phantom family. I kind of wonder, does it tie over to your production as well with some crossover? But actually, Andrew Lloyd Webber apparently always had a strong affinity for that show, too. He loved doing that show. Yeah. But I imagine, you know, this, of course, is... he's done so many shows, but this one has to always remain as one of the favorites that he's ever written.
I would think so. I know it's one of my favorites. I can't speak for him directly, but you know, as a creator myself, an artistic creator, you fall in love with every piece that you do in a different way, you know. But I would have to guess that the success of this show is certainly a favorite of his.
Yeah. Talk to me about the character, the Phantom, because as I've seen it many times over the years, there's times I have a reaction which is, you know, maybe you don't like the Phantom so much, or maybe he scares you. Mm-hmm. But lately, in this sort of new incarnation these last few years, I feel differently about the Phantom. I actually kind of care about him and feel a little sorry for him. How do you want us to feel about the Phantom?
You know, I want people to feel how they feel about him. Some people love him, some people don't love him so much. The way I personally feel about him, I try to bring a more human aspect to who the Phantom is. And like I said a little bit earlier, each of the characters in the show, they're at the base of their emotions, they're very human. And if you think about what the Phantom is enduring in his existence, he's dealing with, in the course of the show, unrequited love, a desire for society to see him in a way that isn't just a first impression, but they dig a little deeper and get to know who he is before they pass judgment. And the list can go on and on and on and on and on of things that I've discovered about his character. But I think consciously or subconsciously, that's what the audience is hooking into. And that's what gives them the, you know, the empathy for him, even though he does do things that are morally unacceptable, you know, in our society for sure. And just to be able to have portions of our lives that we don't get to talk about so readily mirrored on the stage, and to watch somebody go through the emotions of those things, I think it's a cathartic experience, or an experience that really gives somebody a chance to, to exhale, you know, in the theater.
Well put. As you take on this role again after so many years, I'm sort of curious, was your preparation when you first stepped into this, did you sort of go back to the classic French novel, which was called Le Fantôme de l'Opéra by Gaston Leroux? I remember that book, I think, from high school. But did you go back to that, or did you go back and listen to recordings of Michael Crawford, who originated the role? Where was your – did you have a baseline, or did you say, the heck with everything, I'm the Phantom now, and I'm going to do my own thing?
Certainly didn't say that.
Oh, okay. I don't care what Andrew Lloyd Webber says. I'll tell him what I'm going to – no, I'm kidding.
Oh, that wouldn't have gotten me very far. I definitely went back to the novel and read that a couple of times. But then the most work that I did was with the script and the score. I took the scores of all the songs in the show, and I took the lyrics out of the music and read them like poetry, read them like a story of their own, you know, and just tried to read between the lines and feel what Angelo Webber was trying to say and the emotions that he was trying to get across, and then put those things inside of my soul, you know, and got up and got a chance to rehearse it and play in a rehearsal space with the artistic director, Seth Scarhan, and all of the creative team and everybody in the room. I can't remember all their names at the moment, but, you know, and just worked across from a Christine and with a Rao and a Carlotta and everything, and just kind of found my way in the character. And I think every day that I get on the stage, it evolves a little bit more, and I find something new and something fresh. So it's still constantly changing and growing and maturing, but that's basically the way I came about creating the Phantom.
I don't know the answer to this question, but I know that when you're in New York, you often do solo concerts. You've done them at holiday time and all of that. You are in Chicago through the holiday season, my friend. Will you be doing any appearances, any other concerts while you're here, so people can just listen to the beautiful music of Derek Davis?
Well, you know, my website, TheRealDerekDavis.com, carries all of my information. I don't have anything on the books just yet.
Okay.
But you never know. I will be there, and there are several live music venues in Chicago that I would love to jump on the stage and be on the mic for a minute.
Well, listen, I've got a piano in my living room, and I'd be happy to have you do a concert there. Just we'll hang around and we'll watch The Irishman on Netflix or something like that and just sing a few songs from Phantom, right?
That show is amazing.
Well, the main thing is we want people to go see Phantom of the Opera. It's at the Cadillac Palace Theater. Actually, you guys follow White Christmas, which is there just before you. And it's from December 18th to January 5th. Tickets, as always, BroadwayInChicago.com. It's just a treat. You know, I was if you get a chance to see Teatro Zanzani while you're here, if you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's right next to the whatever it's called, the Niederlander Theater now. They keep changing the name. But anyway, and I was there one night, and I was sitting next to somebody who recognized me, and because I also do a Broadway show. And she looked and she said, "When is Phantom coming back? I know it's coming. When is it coming? I see it every time it's here." And
wow,
I told her to
chill
and please stop talking to me. No, I'm kidding. I told her, yes, it's coming back. Yes, you'll be able to get tickets. So I don't remember who she is, but I know you've got one rabid fan who's going to be there.
Fantastic.
During this run, absolutely. December 18th to January 5th, Cadillac Palace. I love that theater. Tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. And you are Derek Davis. You are the Phantom. And I can't wait. I'll be there opening night. So I'll be there. Maybe I'll wear a mask or something so you'll recognize me from my third row seat in the audience.
Fantastic.
But Derek, welcome back to Chicago. Have a great time. And I sure hope you get a chance to do some concerts here. Your website again so people can check. Actually, it's TheRealDerekDavis.com, right?
It is with two R's, D-E-R-R-I-C-K.
You got it. Congratulations, my friend. Break legs while you're in Chicago. It's a great show. You're a great talent. Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Look forward to seeing you as well.
Thank you.
What did you do with it? Idled away your time reading books of poetry when you should have been working. Married a wife who bore you a bairn you can't keep. Hard words, maybe. What are you going to do for your son when the time comes? I've toiled and slaved to give you a name you'd be proud to own. Worked early and late, toiled like a dog when other men were taking their ease. Plotted and planned to get my chance, taken it and held it when it came. Till I thought I'd burst with the struggle. Sell. You talk to me as selling. When everything you'll ever earn couldn't pay me back for the life I've given to you.
I find it hard to just stop listening to that voice and that performance, but we're going to cut it off because we have to talk to the actor who provides that sound. He's one of the greatest and well-known actors in the city. The show we're about to talk about is called Rutherford and Son. It is playing over at Timeline Theater, and that was the mesmerizing voice of one of the city's greatest actors, Francis Guinan, who plays the lead role, Rutherford or Rutherford, in the show. And also joining us, the director of the show, Michelle Moe. And we will hopefully be talking as well with Rochelle Theron, who plays Mary. So welcome, guys. So nice to have you join me and to talk about Rutherford and Son.
Thank you very much.
And I'm just going to, Fran, just for people who may not know your background, I mean, you're in every show that is in the city of Chicago, but specifically, your work at Steppenwolf is unparalleled, True West, The Seafair, August Osage County. There's just no end to what you've done. Victory Gardens, Goodman, everywhere. You also, I believe, you had one of the final performances with John Mahoney in The Seafair. Was that John's final show?
No, actually, it was. The show was the Rembrandt.
The Rembrandt, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, and he's a great loss, but you got to work with him, and I'm sure he is greatly missed.
Oh, and it was. I have to say that particular show is one of the high points of my career in the theater. He was just so wonderful to work with in that scene. So yes, I you're actually talking to the luckiest actor you'll ever slap eyes on. So
well, I love every time I can slap eyes on you.
Fortunate.
The show that you're in over at Timeline, Rutherford and Son, Michelle Moe, you're the director. And when I saw the show, it is you get the sense you're watching a timepiece and stuff, but people might think, oh, maybe this is just some modern piece that somebody wrote and set it back in sort of Victorian times. And that would be wrong.
Absolutely. The play was written in 1912 by Etha Sowerby, who is relatively unknown, but really was just a phenomenal playwright of her time that kind of was lost in our history and died in obscurity. And the play was unearthed a few years back by The National, who just did another production of it this past spring, and was named one of the great 100 plays of the century.
It's a fascinating one to watch. Of course, you are a company director at Timeline, and one of the shows you directed recently was In the Next Room, or the Vibrator play, and Rochelle Theron, who plays Mary in the show. Mary, that means you worked with Michelle before. I mean, Mary. Rochelle, you worked with Michelle before.
Yes, I've been lucky enough to have worked with her twice now. It's wonderful.
And now you get to work with Fran Guinan, and tell the listeners about who Mary is, what role she plays in this show, because, man, she's quiet sometimes, but she's powerful.
She is. She'll sneak up on you. So Mary Rutherford is, she's Mr. Rutherford, his daughter-in-law, and so she's married to John Jr., as we call him, and she has been living in London for about 5 years and then joins the family 3 months prior to the opening of the play. And we see her making that adjustment, struggling to make that adjustment throughout the play.
And of course, her father-in-law, played by Fran, is not always complimentary to her, as we heard in that opening clip that came. Although, as he said, he didn't mean anything by it. He knows it's rough. Fran, oftentimes you play very likable characters. I've seen you in some roles where the audience falls in love with you. This is a bit different. You're not the nicest guy in the world in this show.
Oh no, he's a hard ass. well, I can say that on the internet. He's very hard, and I think he's. But the way Michelle Moe has helped create this character with me is that he's also, I think, quite understandable. Not sympathetic, but you kind of get it with this guy. He's very much a traditionalist and doesn't really brook any opposition. But on the other hand, you get it. By the end of the play, you really understand what it is he's trying to create in his life.
Michelle, the reason I love seeing shows at time
that way.
So yeah, the reason I love seeing shows at timeline is because first of all, it's always tied to history. You can always walk through the lobby and just see all sorts of things on display and whatever. And one of the things that I didn't know, I did not know a lot about this playwright, Geeta Sowerby, if I'm saying that right.
You are.
And one of the things I found fascinating is, you know, I learned she wrote all these children's books and whatever, that she was identified by others in a variety of different ways, but for her, to her, she identified as the playwright. It was more about this kind of work than it was anything she did for kids.
Absolutely. It's really fascinating about her. Again, as I said, this play came out in 1912, and it was really a part of like a new play series, but it was advertised under her initials. So when the play debuted, everyone assumed it was a man that wrote it. And when it came out that it was a female playwright, there was this huge fanfare, and no one could believe that a woman could possibly have such insight into the world of business and the affairs of the time. This is the period right before World War One, and this was set in Northern England, and really when people, a huge rush to join labor unions and big, just, again, the whole feminist movement coming to a head, a lot of things coming to a head, and she was able to kind of take all of these large political and social issues and wrap them into this family drama, which has generational warfare, things that are all very present today in our own lives and things that we're all dealing with. And she wraps it all together in this really beautiful family drama where I believe that everyone can kind of have insight, at least a character that they can follow through and relate to in this play.
Rochelle, let me come back to your character, Mary, again. Yeah. Look, I saw you in Noises Off at Windy City Playhouse. You were so whack, so great in that. And Aspects of Love at Theo Ubuque. I mean, you've done, in fact, I saw you at Goodman, too, in Our Wilderness. You've done such great things. This is a different role for you. I know you talked a little bit before about who Mary is, but when you prepare for a role like this, do you think about the power and the message and the relationship with the audience you need to create without so much of the spoken word?
That's a really great question. You know, Michelle did such a beautiful job directing us and really helping us craft the story that we wanted to tell and share with the audience, and the story that we wanted to tell with our characters and their arcs, really. We definitely discussed, you know, how to, what we wanted the audience to feel about each character's struggle and fight in our show, and so it certainly came into play in our in preparation. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm totally answering that question.
Well, no, it's because you were the reason I even ask it, because to me there is such an intensity about watching you that you know, when you speak it's great, but when you're not, I still find myself looking at you, unless Fran's on stage, and I'm looking at Fran. But but there is there's a real pull to, I think, having you there. And Fran, let me ask you, look, you've worked in so many theater venues around the city, but Timeline, man, I don't think it gets any more intimate than that stage. And so for somebody who's, you know, somebody who's been
like
on the...
being back in the old Hull House again. I mean, you're stepping over people's feet in the front row.
Yeah, that was me. That was me that night, by the way. On a Saturday night, I was right there in the front row. I tried to catch your eye.
Oh, thank God I didn't have my glasses on. It would have, yeah, would have thrown me. You know, it's an interesting thing. You were talking about this, Mary's piece at the very end. She's so close to the audience, and the way Michelle has directed it, when she finally confronts Rutherford, she's pointed straight downstage, and she just lays this out. It's such a huge revelation to the audience. It comes as something of a shock that this sort of diminutive young woman has suddenly just taken this entire situation by the horns. It's really powerful.
There's also, Fran, I'm going to stick with you and also come to Michelle for this. When I watch it, this is not, as I said, it's set, it feels like, you know, like the Victorian piece that it is. But I swear, Fran, watching you, I see, I don't want to say Trump, but I mean, I'm just seeing an influence of those kinds of characters today. It just, maybe because I cover politics, but I just felt like this is a story of today. There are people like that today in this society and in powerful positions.
Oh, absolutely. I think, and you know, there's an entire, you know, pro-business, intellectual backing for this pro-business movement right now. And again, it's quite understandable. History will prove whether it's actually successful or not. We shall see. But yes, it's. I think that's the reason it was chosen for the timeline series this year. It's quite timely.
And Michelle, another piece that again makes you think that this could have been modern. It's the role of women. I mean, written so many years ago, and yet there are powerful women in this show.
Absolutely. And she was capturing a voice that, I mean, really, when you think about it, there were a handful of male playwrights of that era that were capturing that voice. But how wonderful to have a female playwright really lead with that. And as with any great play, and that stands the test of time, and I'm so glad that that was your response to it, and I hope the audiences that come and see it. And that's the whole mission of Timeline, right, is examining what's happening today in the world around us, but through our history, which I think is really exciting and kind of see where we land and where we continue to grow and move forward. But at this time, this particular voice and women expressing their opinions in this way was revolutionary, and that's what really makes it so incredibly exciting to take a step back into that and then to place it where we're at now. And that being said, there's a lot of big things at play here, but there's still a lot of love in this play and a lot of humor where we find it. And that was really important to me and to the cast to really embrace and lift those things up. So you get really dimensional storytelling within this. So while there's a lot of big, heavy things that are at work, it's the human condition too, and with that there is a lot of humor and love and empathy and compassion.
I've become a huge fan of Timeline Theater over these past many seasons. I've actually attended your annual gala now the last couple of years, and of course I work very closely with.
Oh, it's fun, isn't it?
What's that? It's a great night. I spend too much money in the silent auctions, and but
come
I say,
on, come on back.
Right. Oh, I will. I get to join Eileen Lucario and some of the board members and some of the folks. It is such a great experience. But all that aside, Timeline is. I am depressed about one thing. I'm so happy that you guys are getting a new building up in Evanston, but I live about two blocks from the current theater. So.
Well, we're not moving to Evanston. We're moving. We're moving to Broadway at Argyle.
Yeah, so that's right Evanston. In my head, that's out of the. I'm totally kidding.
I think that's Wisconsin, isn't it?
Area. No, we're not as far north.
No, it's going to be. Fran will pick me up on the. Fran will pick me up on the way up there. We'll just go together.
Okay, I'll pick you up.
It's a great thing, you know. Again, we'll be right off of a Red Line train stop, but there'll be parking, and we love our space, but it'll be fun to step into modern times with a new space. And there'll be two theaters at the new location, and that just will allow us, if you're already enjoying the work that we do, it'll provide us opportunities to give more to the community and to explore more, and we're excited. But everything that we do at our home now is we're keeping all of those values. We're just going a little bit farther north with it.
Absolutely. And of
hopefully
course,
everyone will stick with us.
And I will absolutely stick with you because you do such great things. I'm just so happy to walk two blocks and go see you now. But
you still have a couple more seasons.
I know. I'm going
to walk a few blocks.
And you know what, guys? When you're done with the show, if you want to sneak out back and come on over for a drink, you're welcome to do that. Because
careful what you put out there.
Hey, listen.
Yeah,
I've got a whole theater collection.
There's a lot of us over there.
I've got, like, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda's boots from Hamilton. I got all sorts of stuff you guys might want to see. So I do collect a lot of old things.
I think all you need to do is name the date and time, and everyone will be there.
So. Oh, yeah.
We will do it. And then, Fran, you'll have to drop something off from August Osage County to add to the collection or something like that. We'll do that.
Absolutely. I got just the thing.
All right. So Rutherford and Son, I'm sorry, I go back and forth with how to say it. And actually, as I listen to it.
That's a very good dialect, Paul.
Thank you. That's what I was going to say, because that English, Northern English dialect you have in there, it comes out more Rutherford. So I'm trying to be there for you. But this is playing through January 12th at the Timeline Theater, currently before it moves to its new fantastic location, currently at 615 West Wellington in the heart of Lakeview, where I live, and Timeline Theater, spelled the proper English way, T-R-E, timelinetheater.com is where you can get tickets. 773-281-8463 is the theater number. It's an incredible show. Like I said, until I did my homework, I didn't realize that this show was as old as it was, because it rings for today. So powerful, so intimate, and what an incredible cast. And of course, a great director. But Michelle Moe and Fran Guinan, love you always, and Rochelle Theron. I'll look forward to seeing all of you in another show soon. But for now, everybody check out Rutherford and Son at the Timeline Theater, timelinetheater.com. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.